Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know what you've done.
Good evening, and welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now show. This is scan number 2480. That's 2480. Tonight I'm hosting this show, and you know, this is very strange because this last week a lot of people haven't shown, and I think, I don't know, a lot of places have opened and people are just playing out, running around, and breathing, hopefully, fresh air. That's all I can say, okay? But on the other hand, while you're doing all that and while we should be able to do that and we take it for granted until something like this, I call it a plague, okay, came to be, people would have more time to think about other things and being free. And we don't feel free right now. We don't. We absolutely do not. Because all the curfews and all of this and that and, you know, not being able to go here, not being able to go there. And so forth. Well, I have to tell you that where I live, I'm in the country now. I'm not an urbanite right now. I am a country person. I'm learning to be a country person. And things are opening up. And you know what? I am just so happy to see it. I just really am. And I pray to God that that's the right thing to do. But anyway, tonight's special guest is Thomas Gagliano. He's from North Brunswick, New Jersey. I know right where that is because I used to work in Perth Amboy in New Jersey in detox, okay? And so he and I wish he'd come on because he and I lived in and worked in the same areas. But anyway, the point is, right now, I'm going to read the mission statement, and I'm going to see if he shows up. Maybe he's late or I pray to God he's not sick. Who knows? Who knows anymore, okay? Okay, we have a single purpose at NASCA to address issues related to child abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent and physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so two different ways, and that, of course, is educating the public, especially as related to getting society over the taboo of discussing childhood and sexual abuse, presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem. It's not just the United States, it's all over the place. It's all over the world. And you know what? It has been for many years. Okay, now number two, offering hope and healing through numerous paths and providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. Okay. I see a number has just come in. I'm hoping that it's our guest. I'm going to open up the mic and let's just see. But in the meantime, people out there, the number here is 646-595-2118. This guest is quite a guest, okay? He has a lot to offer. And so if you're not too busy preparing for the weekend, and I certainly have to make my salads and stuff when I get off, I understand. But give us a call. Even if you just listen through your computers, I know a lot of people do that. Okay, let me bring this person on. 978, who am I speaking to? This is Carol Levine from the Stop Child Abuse Now show.
Hi, how you doing? My name is Al.
Who?
And Al. A-L.
Oh, okay. Hi. I was expecting our guest. Where are you from?
So,
okay.
Where
are you from? 978. Where is that?
Yes, it's Massachusetts, Lowell, Massachusetts.
Oh, you're from Massachusetts. Okay.
Yeah,
yeah, we get people that call in all over the world. Okay, and we started out as doing this country. You know, that's why we called a National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. But people do call in from all over the world, and sometimes they call in as far as Israel, Vietnam. As well, and other places too. Now, I see that our guest has called in, and this is going to be a good show, all right? So you sit back and listen and make comments, okay? I'll open up your mic, when it's time to do that, okay? Hold on just a second. Let me get my guest on. Hey there, Thomas.
Hi.
How are you?
Good. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. We have one other person that's on right now. They're from Massachusetts. And,
okay.
You know, I was just saying, you know, everything's starting to open up around by me. I don't know what it's like by you.
Nice. Yeah, starting.
You know,
today was, yeah.
Go ahead.
No, today is the first time that in dining for 25%. So it sounds a little bit like we're getting a little back to normal here. In New Jersey, so.
I know. I used to work in Perth Amboy. I know where you're at exactly.
You're right near me.
Yeah, well, I used to work in detox there. I lived in Portland, but I worked in Perth Amboy. And so anyway, I am so interested in your bio. I have it here before me. And I'm going to say your name again. Your name is Thomas Gagliano, and you are from North Brunswick, New Jersey. And
right.
I don't like reading a person's bio, but I do pick from it, okay, at times.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us,
mm-hmm.
We do ask, you know, that our guests tell us about themselves. You know, if you're an abused
sure.
person, you know, go
mm-hmm.
into a little bit of the abuse of what you want to say. And and then we go to what you're doing today, and you have a lot to offer. So I'm going to let you just start right in. Okay, and start
mm-hmm.
telling your story, and then we'll go
sure.
from there, okay?
Sure.
Okay.
Thank
go
you.
Ahead. You're welcome.
So I did come from an abusive childhood. I came from a very insane Catholic school, and I was molested in Catholic school. But what was more important and more devastating to me was my home environment. Because I didn't have a safe place. I come from an alcoholic gambling father and a mom who was a teenager herself when I was born. So it's not just when you get abused outside the home. What's really important is whether or not you have a home that you're safe enough to share your feelings. One thing I've learned, and I've learned this from myself, my experience, or my experience in helping others, is when somebody doesn't feel like they don't matter to their parents, it's not their parents they stop loving. It's themselves they stop loving. And in my case, as in many cases, when you come from a childhood where you really didn't feel like you don't matter, I've learned, and I wrote my books about this, I run my groups on this, I do a lot of these groups for people that come from negative childhood messages. What I've learned is that kind of child will become fragmented. That means they split into two early on in their life. That's an individual. That means they break into two parts. They may show the world their outside part, but they keep their inner self hidden, afraid of rejection, like in childhood. And like recovering addicts, like others that have been abused that weren't able to process their feelings, they grow up to be emotional cripples, like emotional defective people like myself, where many times they act in with depression or they act out with addictions. But they keep themselves hidden. It's important to know that. You know, about 20 years ago, I left the world of business, and being a recovering addict myself, I created a lot of harm to those around me. And I realized that it wasn't that my wife and children didn't love me. It was I didn't love me. And about 20 years ago, I moved away from the world of business that I was very successful in, and I decided I was going to help other people that came from negative childhood messages, whether those messages came from childhood abuse or neglect or whatever, emotional abuse, physical abuse. And I started to run these groups exposing these inner childhood messages for the myths that they are, so we can challenge them, learn that we don't have to be the messages we grew up with. And I started to run these groups, wrote my book. I got myself on TV a few times, radio a few times. And I help people understand that those childhood messages early on that has impacted the intimacy they have or they don't have, their parenting skills, the careers they choose, every aspect of their life does not have to dictate the role that they play in adulthood. And that's part of what I do today. So you can ask me questions from there, and we can go from wherever you want to go.
Okay. Well, you know, that's wonderful. I mean, this is something, too, that I believe, because I had gone through horrific child abuse, and I'm not going to get into my story, but it was just too heavy, right? It was very heavy. And I know I learned on my healing journey, I like to call it the healing journey, that when you get to a certain point, somehow I look back at all those things, those horrific times that I did go through, and all the sexual, the physical, the mental, the emotional abuse and neglect. I went through it all. And I don't see myself as a person anymore. Now it's almost like looking at a movie. It's like this kid who's going through all this stuff, you know, all these things. And I don't have the emotion, you know, attached to that either. At the time, it was horrific. It was horrifying. I was frightened. I was abandoned. I ended up on the streets, all this stuff. And I knew how that felt at that time. But then as years have gone by, and I've done a tremendous amount of healing, now it's like looking at a movie, like I said, and I can look at it not in a different light, because abuse and trauma, that's what they are, okay? Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, we don't let it have to define who we become, okay? We don't have to. And that's getting help along the way. I believe that if people, you know, get help, and it's with a proper, say, therapist or psychiatrist, whatever it might be, in my case was counselors in a prayer group, and they were good. They were real good. And they got me from where I was. Go ahead.
So one of the dilemmas in what you said, which is very true, is those of us in childhood that were betrayed by either our caretakers, caregivers, or by others, what we learn is not to trust people. We learn very early that we can't trust not only the people that abused us, but if we don't come from a safe home, we also learn not to trust the people that are our caregivers. So trust becomes the major issue. Now, when you get older, and if you want to heal and you want to get better, trust becomes the solution. So there's a little bit of a dilemma there, because what I learn to fear, trusting others, is what I need to get better, and it becomes a dilemma. When my clients come to me, one of the things that I tell them immediately is, I understand that you don't trust any process that you can't control. I get it. As a child, if I wasn't in control, as I grew older, I learned the only thing I trusted was anything that I could control. And if I can't control it, I don't trust it. Well, recovery, healing, means you have to trust your healers in your life. That becomes a dilemma. As I call it time traveling, and I talk to my clients about this piece called time traveling. You will time travel. You will look at your therapist, your counselors, your sponsors, whoever are your higher guides, your healers, and you'll time travel back. They may be as different from those people that betrayed you as can be, but it's not them you time travel. It's trusting others with your life you'll time travel. And you're going to run into an obstacle saying, if I trust, I'll get hurt. If I trust, I'll get hurt, even if those people are different from the people you grew up with. So in relationships as well, I tell couples that come to me, you know, you're going to time travel. You're going to bring your childhood messages into your relationships. You're not only in a relationship with your partner, but you're in a relationship with their childhood messages as well, because it's going to show up. It distorts our ability to hear. It distorts our ability. What we hear may not be what the person's saying. So what I teach my clients is to be very aware of their childhood messages. So when that little kid or little girl or little boy inside of them that starts to awaken and gets really scared, you're able to understand that this is my scared little kid inside of me. I want to fight, flight. I want to get out of this. I want to run away. When you understand and build that self-awareness better, you have a better shot of staying in the conversations, staying in the relationship, and not running away from it. So I teach a lot of self-awareness when it comes to this. Be aware of that scared little kid in you. It's going to show up, especially in intimate situations, especially in situations in relationships, because I know as a recovering addict, I'm a guy that went to 12 steps. I did a lot of therapy. I have a master's degree in social work. I learned a lot of book stuff. And the truth is, at the end of the day, all of my isms are going to come out in emotional settings. That's when my fears come up and my self-survival instincts come up. And it's really important to understand that. Yeah.
Ooh. All right, hold on. Let me hold on here a second because I want to bring on the other two people that we have.
Sure.
We have Alex from Massachusetts, and we have Darlene from Tennessee. So let me open up their mics because it is just a couple of us. And then they do know not to speak unless it's their turn. Hold on a second. Okay. So, Alex, you called in first. Say hello to Thomas and, say hello. And if you have a question already or you want to make a comment as to what you've heard, go ahead.
I mean, two things. I want to make a comment on this.
Mm-hmm.
So,
go ahead.
I believe in God, and I know that I've been molested. I've been abused as a child. My mother tried to kill me when I was 6 months old. So if you feel good, you should feel good for it because you weren't.
Sorry
I accept
to hear that.
That's horrible. She rejected me because I was darker skin. My father was Italian, and I was darker skin. So she tried to kill me when I was 6 months, and I had a nightmare every year until I was 10. And actually, my mother said, "Oh yeah, that actually happened. You know, it actually happened. Oh my God, you have a dream with it?" I said, "Yeah." Okay, so that was kind of a joke. But you know, in the God is alive. I was humiliated because I'm a guy, so I got my mother's color. My father's white. So I got my coffee and milk together, and I decided that I wanted to be a better man than everybody else. I decided that I don't want to be the man that I am. I don't want to be the man that my mom wants. I want to be the man that God wants me to be.
Good for you.
And I was molested when I was a child. You know what? I'm over it. And but I was actually harassed by my sister when I was 8, and she accused me that I hit her, and I didn't touch her. So I got for 5 years I have a belt that I didn't feel anymore. My mom beat me so many times that the belt grew like a quarter inch in my skin. I didn't feel anything because I was so mad at her. I couldn't feel anything, and I thought you know this. I couldn't even cry. I tell you, I never cried. From 8 year old to I was adult, I never cried. My mother never saw me cry. It doesn't matter how many times she hit me, and she got so tired of hitting me. Right? I feel sorry for her. It's like, and I look at her like, "What are you doing? Like, you really don't, yeah, I mean, you're hitting me and I haven't done anything for you to hit me." So my sister said that I hit you, and you come and beat me up, and you said that that you're tired of hitting me, and I don't even cried. I was that stubborn. And I said, like, you know, what is this woman? Is kidding me, you know. My mother, I was took out of my mother's womb when I was, like, when I took out of my mother's womb, after a month of being with her, she tried to kill me. So her aunt had to actually have me because she tried to kill me. And she tried to get rid of me. She didn't want her. She didn't want me in her life. So I knew I was rejected from the womb. I had that rejection from the womb. Growing up, my mother got involved. She didn't want my father anymore. She got involved with a wacko head, the crazy guy that liked to hit her and making a scene. And I was a black belt in karate. I was 700 pounds. And he tried to hit me. And the moment that he had to hit me, I stopped him. He hit my sister.
Okay, Alex.
But
Alex.
I'm going to tell you something. Yeah.
Well, hold on a second. This is our special guest tonight, and this is his platform tonight. I would love it. That I know you didn't realize that. That's why I'm interjecting here. I would love it if you would come on and tell your story, so that it would be your platform night where you could tell everyone everything that you're telling and talking about now. And I know there's a lot more that you want to speak about than what you've gotten to. And that's why people come to NASCA on Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Now, tonight's a little different. I mean, yes, our guest is a survivor, but he's also very much a professional survivor, okay? And he's going to tell us how he helps people. He's been on TV, he's been on the radios and all this other stuff. I think we can learn a lot from him, okay? But I would like it if you would come on our show as a guest. Are you willing to do that?
Sure. I just want
to
tell him, you know, he's
not. But don't, no more tonight, honey. No more tonight.
No,
because
he's not the first and the last. I want to hear about him.
And we have Darlene. I have to open. Well, her mic is open. But what I'm trying to get across to you is you have a substance, a story of a lot of substance. And believe it or not, there's a lot of us
really?
Who can identify. You know, that absolutely we can identify, you know, with a lot of the things you've already said, with all the beatings and stuff. What Thomas deals with here is you know, people who down their children all the time. And sure, I'm sure there's a lot of neglect and other things. And we're going to get into that. So I want you to contact Bill, okay, and say that you'd like to be on the show because I think you'd make a good guest.
Oh, thank you.
Is that all right with you? Yes.
Yeah. I just want to tell you. My conclusion was that I want your guest to feel like he has been the person that have suffered the most or anything like that. I want him to know that I know what suffering is. I want to hear his story, and I want him to do whatever it takes to help him and you know. If he needs support, I'm here too. He's not alone.
Okay. No, he's not alone, and neither are you. Okay. So let me go down to Darlene from Tennessee and continue to listen. And what we do on this show is sometimes twice, maybe three times even, we go back to the panel. You're a panel member right now, and so is Darlene. And, you know, so you can ask questions or make a comment about what he's saying. So, I'm going to ask Darlene to say hello and see if she has any questions. And he has so much. I'm going to give out a little bit here, Thomas, okay, because you have been on TV and you have been on other shows, and not like this even. I mean, radio shows. I have, too. And you also wrote a book.
I actually have.
Okay, cool. And anyway, the problem, the name of his book is called The Problem With Me. And he's
a co-writer. I want to be
anonymous.
I'm not ready for that yet.
Okay. Well, let
I'm
me.
A public person.
Let me.
I don't want.
Okay. The problem. The name of the book is called "The Problem Was Me," and that's with Dr. Abraham Twersky. And so, I mean, he's been on all kinds of things, and I do want to get into his story, Darlene. Say hello to Thomas.
Hello, Thomas, and hello, Alex, both of y'all. And, Alex, yeah, thank you for being here. You're now a member.
How do you do?
I am your I am your sister now, Alex. Since when you come here and you're saying you're, you know, part of the family. Okay, Alex, I am so excited to hear more about this. I think I've been here before. I think you've been here before.
Well, I have her on hold now, honey. That's what I do. But anyway, darling, let's get to his story. And
I think he was here before too. He's just let him know that I'm glad he's here, and I look forward to hearing more.
Okay, that's good. Yeah. Okay, I'll put you guys on hold until I come to you again. Thomas, have you been on the show before?
No, not on this show. No, I've been on Dr. Oz. I've been on, a few other shows, TDJ. So I'm on Jenny McCarthy pretty regularly, talking about a lot of things, not just this. But I've been on other shows, but not this one.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Let's go backwards a little bit, if you don't mind, because
sure.
We've had a couple of people call in. And what we usually do on the show, the person does speak about their abuse in a larger way, and then we get to, where they are today and how they got there. So, all right, you came from an alcoholic family, if I'm not mistaken. Your father was an abusive alcoholic?
Yes. My father was a very really respected and powerful man, but when he got drunk, he got very abusive. So I'll give you a picture of my childhood. My childhood was, I was the oldest of four brothers, and I was the caretaker. I was parentified because in many childhoods, when the mom or dad is not getting nurtured properly, they look for one of the kids to kind of fill that role. So it's not unheard of for a child to become parentified, where they're not children really. They become like one of the caretakers. So I was the oldest of four kids. So many nights, if my father didn't come home at a certain time, it meant he was going to come home drunk, and it meant he was going to hurt someone. So if I give you a little picture of my childhood, I was that kid that used to sit at the top of the stairs waiting for him to come home and not knowing if he was going to, God willing, just go to sleep or if I was going to have to pull him off for my mother or where he's going to hurt me. So I was kind of my mother's caretaker. So a few times I got roughed up quite a bit, and my father would always come to me the next day in a very emotional state and say, I'm so sorry, you got to forget what I did last night. And like a good kid, I would say, don't worry, Dad, I'll forget about the whole thing. My mother, on the other hand, was a kid herself when I was born. So when my father was out with all the women in hotels, my mother used to take me to those hotels. She used to sit me in front of the hotel, the hotel door, and she would knock on the door and go hide. And my father would open the door, and there would be me standing there looking at my father and whoever he was with. So my mother was trying to hurt my father the way she was hurting inside. And that's what happens a lot of times in dysfunctional childhoods is the people that are hurting go to hurt people. They don't even realize it sometimes, but that's what they do. So I had that in my childhood. Now, I went to a Catholic school that was very abusive, and I was touched inappropriately a few times by this religious figure. It was they're a brother. They're like young before they become a priest. But the Catholic school, the way that was set up, it was all abuse. So they would call a kid down to the office, and the principal would call the kid in, shut the door, leave the intercom on, and beat the heck out of the kid so the whole school can hear it. All about fear, all about scaring the kid. So I remember one time, in fact, in third grade, I was sitting there, and this over the PA system, they called this girl, third grade, little third grader, to come to the office, and all I saw was just a puddle of urine under her seat. She was so afraid just hearing her name. So this is – when you come from these type of childhoods, there's no safety. You know, one of the things I always teach parents and all others is to validate and acknowledge your children's feelings, because a child that feels like their feelings matter will feel like they matter. It's very important. Even if you disagree with them, let them know when they say something that you heard it and you validate it. So on the other flip of the coin, I came from a childhood where if I was to say what happened to me in school, I was more likely those kind of, well, you deserve it remarks than anything more than, you know, that's terrible what happened to you. So what happens to kids like this, like I said, is they become fragmented. And I heard your first speaker, and what happens is you think you're terminally unique. You believe that nobody will ever understand what happened to you. Children are egocentric. Let me explain, because this is such an important piece for all your listeners to hear. That's this. When my dad came home drunk, okay, at 10 years old, I never said, gee, my dad's an alcoholic. 10 years old, kids 10 years old can't understand that. Their brain's not developed enough. Instead, I said, what's the matter with me? I must be defective, or my father wouldn't be doing this. All children are egocentric. Even when a parent dies, the child thinks they did it purposely to hurt them. They don't know. Their brain is not developed. So our core beliefs that are developed early are really the key. And when those core beliefs are developed early and we don't feel like we matter to our parents, it's not our parents we stop loving. It's ourselves. And that has to be fixed. I'll go into a little bit later on what I do in my groups, which will be fascinating, on how we heal that wound. But for me, I closed up. I did very well in business, but I never let anybody close to me, never. And as I said before, my wife and kids eventually left me, and it wasn't because they didn't love me. It's because I didn't love me. I wouldn't let anyone close. That's the fragmentation. I show the world one side. You know, addicts are all different from the outside. They come in different colors. We come in different religions. We come in rich, poor. But on the inside, addicts are all the same. There's a feeling like they don't belong, like they're a part from instead of a part of. And that's what I work in my groups. And that's how I banned recovering addicts, because many recovering addicts have been abused. And I'll tell you something funny. With all the abuse I had, there is one of the worst abuses is verbal abuse. I can tell you that some of the wounds that I had healed, even the molestation healed, but the words that my father would tell me, that I was no good, I was a loser, I wasn't good enough, those are the things that get ingrained. And those things unleash a tsunami of negative thoughts throughout your life unless you expose them to other, I call, witnesses, people that know your truth.
That's true. That's very, very true. You see, I see that you were a part of the Script Conference too, as well. Is that correct?
Yes, I was. Very good.
Yeah, this is the first year I actually didn't host it because everything was so different this year. Okay.
Oh, I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah, well, I was hosting from you know the computer from the studio. I would host the show, and Bill would be
nice.
Out there, and Excuse me. Isn't this something how we all have trouble with our throats? This is weird. But anyway.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, something.
There's something
I'm
in the air.
I'm drinking water here. I don't know what the heck happened. Yeah.
I don't
That's
like
funny.
It. But anyway, there's some things that I want to speak about here, points that you've made that all the survivors, you know, we all go through this, but it's crucial and that they hear that it's normal. All right. Now, one thing you did say is that you were, that children always feel different than. I felt terribly different. I always felt a part, and I mean a part. In other words, not a part of, like you said, because we do have such low self-esteem. And if children are told all their lives, which was my case also, I mean, all of us, many of us, most of us that come from the dysfunctional homes, if we're, and I teach this also too, if you're told day after day after day after day that you're not going to matter to anything anyway, so go out and get a job, go to the dime store. Well, that's fine if you're a kid, okay? And I did go to the dime store. They put me in the candy section. That was a very bad no-no. I ended up in Staples, all right?
Right.
Just a little funny there. But the point is, I thought I couldn't do any better than the dime store, all right? Because I've been told that for so many years. And this is what happens you know, until you learn that you and there's nothing wrong with people working in dime stores, don't get me wrong. But what I'm saying is, for those of us, we realize that we do have talent. We do have much more, you know, intelligence than we realize. A lot of times that gets stunted because when we do go to school, we've been told, we've been programmed, if you will, that, you know, that we're never going to amount to anything, so really we don't have to listen. And if you're being terribly
right.
abused at home, it's very hard to concentrate anyway, you know, to even
right.
concentrate
right.
on school.
Right.
So the things that you're saying are right, you know, down our alley where kids hear this. And then you mentioned, too, and I think this happens in many families, Thomas, in many families where there's so much dysfunction going on. My first abuse started watching, yes, domestic violence, and that was at the age of 4.
Right.
And
right.
I was the kid sitting at the top of the steps. They didn't know I was doing that.
Right.
Okay. My mother,
I hear
father.
You,
they
boy. That's me. I got you.
Okay.
Yep.
This is what happens. And my brother, mm-hmm. who was 5 years older than me, he hid under the covers. But I could understand that because my father hit him, saying.
Right,
so,
right.
And I didn't know if I was going to get hit. You see, everything you just said is like a duplicate. And unfortunately,
right.
there are so many of us that go through all of this, and we do become like the caretaker. I started and from 4 to 5 anyway in that position. Then I got moved out of that house and into another house, another home, and the whole 9 yards, which I'm not going to go into. But it was ugly. We'll leave it at that.
Sure, I believe
it. But this
it.
Is what happens. This is what happens with kids. Okay?
Yep.
Because
they're egocentric. Yeah. It's the egocentricity
yeah,
of children. Their brain is not developed. So everything that my son asked me at 5 years old, what are you getting me for Father's Day? Because
oh,
in his world, yeah, in his world, everything revolved around him, which is what happens to all children. But go ahead, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. No. I'm just identifying and also bringing out for the listeners. You see, a lot of times we have people listen on their computers and they're going to see a lot of identification, you know, with
yep.
what you're speaking about. And I just want them to know that they're not alone because, you know, we have, like you said, you also mentioned that at nighttime, I don't care who you're with, you go to bed by yourself because you have your thoughts, okay? And,
yeah.
you know, my mind likes to race. I'm a little bit hypervigilant, still working on that. But my mind does race at times because it will go back, as you said, and you did it so well. The words that are spoken
right.
can be wonderful or it can be very, very, very bad for a child. Very, very bad, very damaging.
They get ingrained. Yep, they get ingrained, absolutely.
They absolutely do. So I'm looking at your bio here. And talking to kids about tough stuff, what is that, the 7 essential areas of parenting?
Well, I did that on the script. I spoke about addictions on script, about what we're talking about, fragmentation, egocentricity, and the solution is congruency. And I also
mm-hmm.
spoke about talking to your kids about the tough stuff. You know, many times, I have another book. I don't know if you know, the second book is called Don't Put Your Crap in Your Kid's Diaper Because the Cleanup Costs Last a Lifetime. So the name of the book is Don't Put Your Crap in Your Kid's Diaper. Now, I wrote this book because many parents out there, doing the very best they can, you can only give your children what you know or what you have inside. And many times we put so many of our fears, expectations into them, what we want from them, and we don't even know it. We create such fears, helicopter parents, that the child, when they get old enough, is afraid to walk out the door, or we do other things. So this is why
mm-hmm.
I wrote this book. So talking mm-hmm. to your children about the tough stuff, one of the most important things is, first and foremost, as I said earlier, is to validate your children's feelings. A child that feels their feelings are validated will feel they're validated. So when I say talk to your children about the tough stuff, we've got a lot of craziness in this world right now. And instead of assuming that you know how your children are thinking, because you don't, you know, we don't even remember clearly how we thought so many years ago because we've had so many experiences, our brain has developed. So what I say to parents is don't assume you always know what your child's thinking. Be curious. Ask them, how do they feel about this virus or about violence going on or prejudice? So ask them how they're feeling and validate it. But the other piece I talk about all the time is when your child is struggling with anything, when you see them struggling, maybe they had their heart broken or they made an error in a game or they failed a test, don't jump in right away and fix the problem. Take a second. Think about what would you have wanted to see from your parents at that age. Let that compassion guide what you say and the way you say it. So I use an example with my youngest son. And the example was at a baseball game. He was pitching in high school, and he didn't pitch well at all. And I was walking to the dugout, and I said to myself, I wonder what I can do to help my son. Maybe I could teach him a little better on his delivery and pitching. Maybe I could put my therapist hat on and ask him how he's feeling. When I walked in the dugout in front of all his fellow teenage friends, he looked at me and he said, Dad, I need a hug. That's all he needed. Mm-hmm. He didn't need a therapist. Mm-hmm. He didn't need a pitching coach. He needed a hug from his dad. So I try to explain to parents, before you jump in and always fix things and always lead them the right way, you could do that later. When your child's struggling, you can, I'm sure, attest to this because of similar backgrounds. When we were hurting, what did we need more than a hug? Nothing. That is exactly what we needed. Then we could talk about whatever we want to talk about. So when I wrote my book and talking to your children about the tough stuff, I just went through a lot of different ways you could communicate with your child. Here's one of the things that all people have an issue with, and that is they don't like uncomfortable conversations because uncomfortable conversations bring out emotions. But I try to teach parents and I teach couples, those uncomfortable conversations, if done in an empathetic way, is the path towards emotional intimacy. It's really how we get close to each other. And we may not want to do it because to many of us, feelings in childhood weren't good. They weren't positive. They weren't helping us. So our brain right away says, don't do it. You're going to get hurt. Don't do it. So we distract ourselves. That's what addicts do. They distract their feelings with alcohol or drugs or pornography or eating. So this is some of the things that we do. But I teach couples, I teach parents, walk through that conversation. Put it out there in an empathetic way. No yelling and screaming and no shutting down, because that's how you build closeness. But here's one of the big pieces. You and me had definitions of intimacy that weren't good. We saw intimacy, if you will, between our parents, yelling, screaming, hurting. So we grow into adulthood saying, who wants that? Are you kidding me? Intimacy isn't warmth, trust, closeness. Intimacy is just yelling and screaming and fighting. Who needs it? So we have to challenge our definition of intimacy so that we know how to do it right. Because if we don't challenge it, intellectually we may know that that's not intimacy, but emotionally we're going to shut down, yell and scream, or run away when we have emotional feelings coming up because we don't know how to regulate it. We don't know how to process it because nobody ever showed us how to do that.
That's right. That's right. You know, we are what we see so often, you know, and it causes such terrible damage. You know, when you see parents that are beating each other to the point of almost killing each other, for God's sake. I used to watch knives flying back and forth. And all these things, you know, it causes a tremendous amount of damage, so much trauma, all right, so much trauma. And what you were saying,
distrust.
You know, yes. And then, but what you were saying, too, about a hug or a kiss or whatever to your child. There are many of us who never got that, ever.
Exactly.
Ever. Okay. And that's what we deal with on the show, too, is we have children that don't have parents that cared enough. Yes, they do need those classes.
Absolutely.
You know, you bet. They cared enough. Sometimes it's court-ordered, you know that, but it doesn't matter. If they come in on their own, you know, looking for help, how do I deal with my children, that's wonderful. If it's court-ordered, still in all, you still hope that they pick up the same amount of information because in the back of their heads many times when it is court-ordered, they're already angry people, and they're just mad because they have to sit there, and you're hoping that you're getting through to them. But you know what I'm talking about. So what I'm trying to get across here to the people who are listening, there are many of us who didn't have that hug, who didn't and crave it. I crave it today. Okay, I didn't get over that. And you know what? I don't care. I'm glad I'm a huggy person. If someone gives me a hug, I'm just so happy.
That's my groups. That's what happens in my groups. Exactly what you're talking
about.
That's
right. That's
exactly what
right.
you're talking about. Yep, yep.
It's
and
that little child within. Yes, it's that little
we
child
all
within.
Have, yep, mm-hmm. And we all have a scared little boy or girl when we come from a dysfunctional childhood that's so scared mm-hmm. of showing their insides, of being vulnerable, because they're going to get hurt again, that we constantly mm-hmm. time travel as adults, constantly, when those feelings of vulnerability come up. So I try to teach my clients my groups are very close with each other. They're all on group text. They call it their families, so that when things come up that are conflicting or emotional, they're learning how to regulate those feelings like healthy adults, not scared little kids. So when they learn to regulate it with the group, to express their feelings, put boundaries down when people are verbally abusing them or whatever, learning how to, I call it, put your big boy, big girl shoes on, not your scared little children. Take care of your scared child inside of you, but show up like an adult. And it's a process that's not easy when you've come from those kind of dysfunctional childhoods. It's not an easy process at all. So my goal with my clients is to get them to be congruent. Take them from the fragmentation that occurred early on in childhood, where they split into two, and they dare not
right.
show anybody their insides because they were afraid they were going to be rejected, and become congruent. So when they become congruent, then they become one person. What I say, I mean. What I mean, I say. And at that point, now I'm an empowered adult, and I'm starting to feel like I belong. I'm not a part of anymore. I'm not a part from anymore. I'm a part of now.
That's right. It's like the two personalities have to integrate and become
Without
one.
A doubt.
Yeah.
Without a doubt.
And I understand that because I used to work with that. But, you know, I'll tell you what, I'm going to go to the panel. And this is very, very interesting, you know, for people to listen to because there's many people out there who had fragmented, okay? And they didn't understand. Mm-hmm. Maybe they thought they were crazy, and many people do think they're crazy when that does happen. And it's actually the mind's way of it's a safety net. That's what I like to call it, as a safety net. And then
the two
come together. Yes.
Yep.
Yes, exactly. Let me go to Darlene. I'm going to start at the bottom here this time, then go up to the top. She might have a question she'd like to ask.
Mm-hmm.
Hello. Excuse me. Yes.
Another one.
I had a tear in my throat.
No, we know.
Yes, I know what you mean about the different personalities because, you know, I was split so much. But as a psychiatrist once told me years ago, he's the one that helped me to start on the right path. He told me, if anybody ever calls me crazy, he said, you're doing a damn good job considering everything you went through. So don't let nobody ever tell you you're not doing a good job.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he's the first one that believed me, so it's very important to find a therapist who believes you.
And so you a therapist you trust, right.
Yes. And See, my trust was bad because even after my abuse as a kid, I was abused by my husband, and then the police had came and said that my husband could hit me all he likes as long as he didn't kill me. The church said, one of the elders said, it's best to let my husband kill me. It's my only way to heaven. But no one would stop in and help, you know. So what, that kind of circumstance, I wanted to die, you know. I didn't feel like I had any options. So I thought my best bet was go to another city, but any time I went to a new city with that type of church that I was visiting, I was forbade because they would call the old church. So so it's like it still followed me no matter where I went, not from my inner self, but from there, you know, from the past people that was cruel to me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's like it followed you, but it's best a lot of times to get away from the toxicity as far as you can.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Henceforth, I escaped from my ex-husband, went all the way to New York State from Alabama.
Well, you know, Darlene, it is very hard. It is very tough. But, you know, again, now you use the word crazy. And no, people are not crazy, okay? Unfortunately, the background that we come from, they try to instill that in us, you know, that and if we're when we're children, our minds are like sponges, and here we are looking up to people that are supposed to be nurturing us. And, you know, it's not a good thing, because then a child starts thinking, well, maybe I am crazy, you know, maybe there is something really wrong with me. And that's not the case.
Yeah.
It's them. It's not you. It's them.
And it's
not
like
you.
And it's like what I shared with them last night, is that my the name I'm using is my author name, and my original name means God's gracious gift. And it's kind of funny because family always told me that I was not wanted. I was a mistake, even a God. And then, but my name, they named me. And it meant God's gracious gift, you know. So I laugh about that today.
Nice.
Well, it's good that you're able to laugh about it today, and you have, you know, you're growing, Darlene, is what's happening. You're growing. You're going on that healing journey. You've been on the healing journey, and you're going further along. You're able to look back now at this point in your life, and you can see that you were just a child, and this is what Thomas is speaking about. You know, is we were just kids. You
and
know, like somebody
ourselves,
asked me,
you know.
Sure.
And we always blame ourselves, you know. We said we were so bad, we did deserve it, but what we did so bad, you know?
Yeah, but
why don't
they
love us?
You're right.
But it took me so long to realize I needed to put the blame where it needed to be, and that was my problem. I was accepting the blame for so long, it was kind of hard to stop blaming myself.
Well,
yeah.
You know, as children, your brain isn't developed enough to understand all that you know as an adult. So only a child says to themselves, well, if mom and dad, the people in my life that are supposed to love me and take care of me and protect me the most, if they don't do that, my God, what's the matter with me? What's the matter with me that the two people that I'm told are supposed to love me? You know, when I have clients, one of my biggest obstacles is to get them to see their parents in a way where I'm not telling you you had bad parents, I would never say that to somebody, but I will tell you that they might have given you messages and experiences that are hurting your life, and you need to challenge those experiences and messages, or they're going to keep you imprisoned. So it's more of looking at what experiences and messages are very, very powerful, because they will dictate what our core beliefs are, and to challenge whatever messages aren't helping you in life. Because, again, nobody here is responsible for their childhood trauma. No one. But I believe we're responsible for healing that. Because if we don't, we're never going to find peace. We're never going to find happiness. And we're going to just drink a lot of poison down and hope other people die, which isn't going to help us.
It's like with my sister, Gwen. Oh, she's a preacher. And she goes around telling me, well, you know, the sex abuse and everything daddy did to you was your fault for being a bad girl. I said, even
yeah,
at age
there
two,
you go.
I said, yeah.
There you go.
She said it was my fault. And I was like, so a lot of my family I had to disown, you know what I mean? Because I didn't need that toxicity, you know what I mean? How was I going to get better
not.
If I was receiving around people that was giving me back that negative message, you know?
And again, as a child, those people that are giving you that negative messages are exactly the people that should be loving and protecting you. At least that's what we believe. So it's not, you know, it's not strangers. These are the ones that you're supposed to get love and protection from. So it becomes so difficult. And if they can't give it to me, then who in the world is going to? No one. And that's when we start to close up and start to become isolated. And I say it all the time. Isolation is one of the most comfortable yet toxic places for somebody to be who has had a traumatized childhood.
Yeah, out of that, develop agoraphobia, the fear of going anywhere, you know?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I was hurt so much, I was afraid to even step out on my front porch. It was so bad.
Absolutely. And the truth is, with your childhood, who could blame you? You were taught very clearly that this is a dangerous world. So why would you think any differently? And that's the compassion that we have to build. And sometimes we need that from other people if we can't find it within ourselves. This is why all healing and recovery becomes a we process, not a me process. This is why I facilitate groups. This is why I do what I do. Because sometimes hearing from other people that we're okay just the way we are may not be the message we're telling ourselves. You know, when I wrote my first book, The Problem Was Me, I talk about this warden, this fictitious inner critic that sat on my shoulder my whole life, always telling me what I was doing wrong, never allowing me to celebrate anything, always running to another dilemma. And I had to get that warden, that fictitious character, off my damn shoulder, or he was going to imprison me to just a very miserable, unhappy life. And I talk about my life story and this story with others on how we get rid of that internal, intrusive inner voice that many of us have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that reminded me of some cartoon characters, you know, back in our day when they had the devil on one shoulder and the bad person on the other, and how they kept trying to nick that negative energy off the shoulder, you know?
Right, I remember that. Yep, I remember that. Yep.
So that kind of reminded me of that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
But thank you so much. I'll let you go. I want to hear more.
Thank you.
Yeah, he has. I told you he has a tremendous amount of information to offer. Okay. So the people
yes,
out
does.
There. Yes, he does. And so the people out there who are listening, I'm sure there's a lot of identification. It doesn't matter if you're traumatized once or if you're traumatized 1,000 times. Trauma is trauma. And it can
mm-hmm.
have a lifetime term sentence to it. And it's something
yep.
that, you know, that does happen. Let me go up to Alex and see if Alex has a question now about what we're speaking about here. Okay. Alex, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I listened to
mm-hmm.
Whatever you guys said. I just want to make a comment. It doesn't matter for me if I've been molested, if I was beat up when I was a kid. It doesn't matter that what my past looked like. I made a decision to be the best person that I can be. And I am not going to let nobody to tell me what to do. I'm going to be the best man that I can be. And I am not going to allow nobody to tell me who I should be. I know my past, that it's painful, but I decided that I can be better than that, and I refuse to repeat the same story.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also willing to do whatever it takes to do so.
Well,
nice.
I think it's good. I think it's, yeah, I think it is nice. I think that it's good that, Alex, that you are at the point where you don't care, because I don't care either at this point, what people, you know, think about me. At one time, oh, my God, if someone didn't like me, oh, my God, I was crushed, okay? Oh, no, honey.
Right?
I'm not like that anymore. I sat down and had a talk with myself, and I won't tell you what it was because it wasn't nice. But the point is it helped because I had to come to the realization that the people who are knocking us down and stepping on us, if you will, are the ones that are the sick ones. They're the ones that maybe they came from a background that was equally as what they're giving us, or worse. But the point is they don't have that right. We have a right to be happy.
Mm-hmm.
We have a right to, you know, do good things in our lives and to see what our talents are and to use our talent and to be who we want to be. We have this right. It's just that we were told as children that we didn't have any of those capabilities, you know, to become what we want to be today. So let's go back to Thomas. Shall I call you doctor? You're a doctor to me.
No, I'm not a doctor. Just Tom is good.
Well, you're doing a good job. Let's put it that way, okay? You remind me of some of the people that I worked with, you bet. And you do sound just like a doctor. But
I'm more like a guy that was born and raised in Brooklyn than a doctor. But go ahead.
Yeah, well, I understand Brooklyn. I lived in Staten Island, so I understand
that.
Oh,
there you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
I used to go to school in Travis. Oh, my God. Right by the dumps. It was disgusting. But anyway, we won't talk about that. What you're speaking about, though, how it affects children for the rest of their life. Well, let me ask you something. You have, let's say you're running a class, okay? And whether it be court ordered or not, you're running a class. And you have addicts in that class. Now, many times the addicted mind, I don't have to tell you this, but the addicted mind is so sick yet from the addiction that how do you handle? Yes. How do you handle? I think first, do you tell them to go and get sober first, to get clean, whether it be alcohol, drug abuse, same thing to me, that's a drug addiction. Go ahead.
It's important to understand one thing first and foremost.
Mm-hmm.
People get help when they want to, not when they need to. So when I have an addict, the first thing I assess is, does this guy want to get better? If the guy is struggling with addiction but wants to get better, that means he's going to take some direction. Now, if I have an addict that really needs to get better, that doesn't want to get better, I basically keep the door open and say, listen, you know, you're not ready. That's okay. You need to be hurt a little more. You need to get a little more sick and tired of being sick and tired. Usually, addicts become ready in one of three areas. Either they got legal problems, DWIs, gambling, they stole money, whatever. Employment problems, where they can't hold a job because they either can't show up to work on time or they're watching porn in work, whatever the heck it is. Or family issues, where their wife or husband say, listen, get help or get out. Those are the three areas that will usually get an addict to be more willing to get help. Now, when they're willing to get help, if I see that, I give them a little bit of my experience. I said, listen, I didn't trust anyone when I started this process. I had to come to believe, like it says in the steps, that I am going to be happier in sobriety than I am in recovery. And I don't expect you to buy into that right now. It's okay. Recovery is sobriety in the beginning is getting your feet to places where it has to be, whether your head tells you to go there or not. 12-step meetings, therapy, support groups, whatever. Your head's going to give you every reason in the world to say that you're different, you don't fit, they don't understand you. That's okay. But get there anyway. Give yourself enough time that you can allow some of this into your own belief system, okay, even if you don't think it's going to work. Part of recovery sometimes is doing it before you feel like doing it. Sometimes if you wait till you feel like doing it, you may never do it.
You don't do it.
So I try to explain all of these things. And I give a lot of my experiences in my life. When an addict says, wow, he gets me. He's not just the guy that's got diplomas on his table. This guy understands it because this guy's been there. Many times that gets them to trust me just a little bit more or enough where they may start to take some direction.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. Isn't it amazing that when you're giving a presentation or you're teaching a class, whatever the case might be, and someone's been, they're sitting there, they're playing with their pen, or maybe they're looking at their phone, they're doing this or they're doing that, and they've been doing it for a while. You just feel like, ooh, you want to go over and shake them and say, hey, wake up. This is about you, okay? Thomas. No, that's all right. All of a sudden, and I know you've seen this, all of a sudden, you'll say the right word, whatever that word might be. With the right sentence. And that same person will look up at you, and all of a sudden they'll start to listen. And so what you just said a minute ago is so true. Even if you don't think you're ready, even if you're bored, whatever the case might be, you're just there because you have to be, or whatever, to give yourself time, you know, because you have to take responsibility first, though. That you're an addict.
Yep.
Right.
Right. But the victim seat is very comfortable for addicts. The responsibility seat, oh my God, that's not cushiony enough. It doesn't feel good. That's the problem. See, I know from my childhood that I was a victim as a kid, a legitimate victim. Things happened to me and to everybody on this show that they didn't deserve. And that, but the problem with that, with addicts, it creates a victim mentality. In other words, the world owes me. The world owes me. And what happens to addicts is they develop this destructive entitlement that gives them permission to do things regardless of the pain it causes themselves or the people they love. And that's the migration of what addiction is. They go from the victim mentality to isolating. They're not talking to anybody but themselves, the wrong person to talk to. And then they come out with destructive entitlement, actually telling them, hey, I nothing wrong with me. It's this world that's screwed up. So I teach them how to get out of that victim seat because that victim seat is destroying them. And when I see somebody that's there but doesn't feel like being there, I'll ask them a simple question. Why are you here? Very simple. Why are you here? So if they're there for a reason, there's something inside of them, unless they're mandated to be there, there's something inside of them that wants help, that's screaming for help, but saying, but don't get too close. So I want to get to that in a voice that is saying, I'm here because I really need help. Even if my affect, my outside is saying, you know what, stay the heck away from me. So that's the voice I want to get to. Because if I bring that voice to the light with the help of other people, because I'm a fellowship guy, I get these guys in my group where they say, my God, these guys accept me for who I am. My God, nobody ever did that before. They start to feel a part of, as I said earlier. So that's kind of what I do. And what I call it is developing witnesses. Witnesses are those people in your life that know your truth as an addict. They know your deepest secrets because we're only as sick as those deepest secrets, but they know your truth. People that know your insides and outsides. So during the course of a week, as I said earlier, when you're discomforted by anything, instead of regulating it with a drink, drugs, or whatever your MO is, you're going to regulate it with people now. We're going to start to trust this process, this we process, with people and allow people to help do for us what we can't do for ourselves. So basically, we're backtracking. We're going back, and now we're saying, okay, you know what? People hurt you, but people can help you. So let's reexamine this whole thing.
You're letting yourself be vulnerable, okay? You're allowing yourself
scary
to be vulnerable.
Though.
Because we put up that brick wall, as we call that on the show, you put up that brick wall as we're growing up and before we reach that point of wanting that help and being different, and it's okay to want that help. You put that brick wall up and you're not able to grow. And then all of a sudden,
right.
you come to a point, hopefully in your life, hopefully, where you do want to learn to love. You do want to learn to trust. You do want to learn to move forward and to become maybe the person that you're meant to be.
And it's important
okay.
to understand that that brick wall you're talking about was
mm-hmm.
self-survival as a child. It wasn't wrong. It was what you did to survive. Nobody
right.
would ever tell a child, you can't survive. I mean, they would say, hey, you do what you need to do to survive. So we built this brick wall in childhood, and it wasn't bad in childhood. It was part of our survival instincts. But now in adulthood, it's not working too well. So we have to – that's why I go back to the childhood messages. We got to understand that that brick wall was at one point in our life very important. It protected us from harm. But now we have to change it. See, I try to do it in an empathetic way where people can empathetically understand this and really have compassion for exactly how they came to be who they are. Not just who they are, but how they came to be who they are, so that it puts the
mm-hmm.
jigsaw puzzle together just a little bit easier.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But how do you get a person over? I'm looking here at your bio. I agree with everything you're saying, and I can relate to a lot of it. I'm an alcohol drug addict. Do I sound like it today? No. Okay.
Of course
and,
not. Right.
But I started drinking when I was 16, and then I started popping pills.
Sure.
I was doing Quaaludes. I shouldn't be here. The two
yeah,
of them
right.
together. Holy.
Many of us.
Oh, my
right.
God. You know. But,
many
of us. Yep. I know. But when you have a person who is racked with negative thinking, okay, and the acting out of an addict, how do you reach that person? They're so negative. And a lot of times, too, let me say something. You're always speaking about the person being withdrawn, is what you're saying, is withdrawn.
Isolation,
I became
right.
just the opposite. Yeah, isolated. I became so tough that people were
mm-hmm.
afraid of me. Okay, so I went from
right.
one extreme
well,
to the other extreme.
Right. Well, but either way, you the same outcome. If see, I was more angry as well too, and you could
mm-hmm.
say tough. I know what you mean. But either way, it pushes people away. Either I'm too tough for them to get close, or I'm too isolated for them to get close. It's still just the same thing, only done in a different way. So
mm-hmm.
that's what I'd say to people is in conversations, addicts either shut down and flight or they get angry and push people away. But the same outcome happens because that's, you know, that's what we do. But when you talk about negative messaging, that's my book. That's The Warden. Now, you know,
mm-hmm.
many times, and I have clients that they come from such dysthymia, I think it's called in DSM, they come from such a negative outlook on life
mm-hmm.
that every story they make up is a negative one. Every story they make up is what's going to happen with my kids, my business, my work, my house. Well, everything ends up with a catastrophizing ending to it. So I challenge them. I say, keep talking about the story you're making up. For instance, business was worse this week. Yeah, but does that mean you're going to be out of business next week and be on a food line? No. So challenge the stories you make. My daughter failed the class. Does that mean she's going to get kicked out of school and she's going to become nobody? Challenge the stories you're making up. Because when somebody comes from a negative childhood like that, every story they make up, which is what they think is going to happen, always is catastrophized or awfulized. So when I have a client like that, I'm constantly telling them to play the tape forward. Play the whole movie forward. Get to the end. What is the story you're making up? Challenge that. Is that real? I mean, if I have a bad week at business, do I think I'll be out of business next week? Is that a manufactured fear or is that real? It's manufactured. It's false evidence appearing real. So I get them to talk about the stories they're making up. Like I said, my daughter failed a math class. Does that mean she's going to get kicked out of school? No. That's an imagined and manufactured fear. So I tell them to be aware of the story they're making up so that they could blow up that story and not make the story reality.
Right. And you see, they're so depressed and so backward and so inside of themselves, and they can't see beyond their nose because it's become a way of life to them. And so when
and
you tell them
yeah.
to fast
mm-hmm.
forward it, yes, yeah, and tell the story and so on, so like what you were saying, it might give them a different perspective of what could be.
Right.
They're so filled with fear. They're filled with failure. All kinds of things are going through people's minds that have been abused and, you know, are just struggling to survive. I've noticed that during this time now with the pandemic, okay, and with all the terror in the streets, which is going on, it's so ridiculous. I don't even want to get into that because I just get mad. But the point is, people are so frightened now. They're so terribly frightened, and the suicide rate has gone sky high.
Drug addiction, suicide, everything.
And the ER is filled
with
children coming in with broken bones, and so forth. So and even the sexual abuse. Imagine being a child. Now this is a hard thing to imagine, but many of us have been there. Being a child who's stuck in the house with a pedophile. You're stuck in a house with that pedophile. You have no place to go. I'll use myself. I had no place to go. I didn't know where my mother was. I had no telephone number for her. My father took off to California. This is when they split and I ended up in this house. I felt so depressed. I felt like I was 50 years old at the age of 7. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
I was running fear. So everything was always, I couldn't see forward. I had trouble seeing in the future because I was so busy trying to, you know, live in the present and stay safe. There are people that have lives like that. And, so when you put yourself in a situation like that, that's a difficult case, and it could take, you know, more time to help that person, to reach that person, to give them hope, to help them see the light at the end of the tunnel, okay?
Yeah, you
to
see,
help them see
everything
the light.
Really, right, everything begins with self-awareness. Self-awareness allows me to understand the actions I need to take that's going to help my life.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm working on my foot and it's my shoulder that's the problem, I'm not helping myself, am I? No. So my self-awareness starts to make me aware. When you say fear, when people are very afraid, their go-to mechanism is control. They feel, I work with a lot of people that have infidelity in their marriage. So the wife feels, well, to satisfy my fear, I'm going to control him. I'm going to know where he is all the time. I'll know what he's doing every second. At the end of the day, if that guy, let's say, is going to act out, he's going to act out, and you're not going to catch him. But your knee-jerk reaction is, if only I could control him. This is what we see with the pandemic, too. People are afraid, so they want to control everything. They want to make sure their kid is where they should be. They want to make sure that those people wear masks and they're distancing and they're full of control. It's not. There's nothing wrong with taking healthy actions at all. But when we're afraid, we begin to become almost controlaholics, that we try to make everybody think and act the way we want them to. And boy, you get in trouble when you do that, because control is uncontrollable. Everybody ain't going to read your script. So when people are afraid, they resort to control as their go-to mechanism. When I see one of my clients angry, okay, I know that that's not the feeling. I tell them, stop. What awakened in you? What are you afraid of? What pain awakened in you? Let's stop with the anger and let's go to when they said this or she said that or they did this, I felt what? Because a pain awakened in you. You reacted with anger, but that's really just covering up a pain inside. So many times we react one way But really, it's covering up another feeling. Anger could cover up pain. Control can cover up fear. So I try to get to what they're not saying, what their feelings are, not what they're showing. And when I get there, now I'm underneath. That now I'm inside of them. And now we can have a really good session, whether it's a couple session or an individual session or a group session. Because that's what I try to get to. Not what I see on the outside, what emotion they're covering up on the inside. Many people, addicts or not, don't know how to express their feelings. Even people that aren't addicts, regular people that haven't been, because their parents never showed them how to do that. So they're not able to say, hey, honey, when you did this, that was hurtful. I'm not saying you meant to hurt me, but that was hurtful. I need to tell you that because it's important for me to get close to you or build our relationship. Very few people know how to say that. All they know how to do is react. Mm-hmm. And reacting is just going to push the other person away. It's not going to pull anybody closer.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Especially if that reaction is maybe volatile or whatever, you know.
Exactly.
That reaction.
Controlling. Yes. Nobody likes to be controlled. Or anger. Mm-hmm. Nobody likes mm-hmm. other people to be angry at them. Or even shutting down. You know, you're talking to somebody, and my wife, in the beginning of therapy, it's like she went away. I'm like, you know, I can make up 5 stories of something I did or didn't do because you're not expressing how you feel. So shutting down is also silent treatment. I say all the time to my clients, that's abusive. When you give your partner the silent treatment, it's abusive. You're not letting that person have any clue as to how you're feeling, what you're doing, what you're mad at. It's abusive. So, again, all of what we do on the outside is not – we're not explaining how we're feeling on the inside.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I like that. I like what you just said because there are so many people that do use the silent treatment, okay? And, you know, it causes a lot of discomfort and a lot of pain to your partner. If your spouse or your significant other, whatever, is giving you the silent treatment because you don't know what's going on in their head and you know how you feel, that is abusive. I agree with that.
Yep. Yeah.
I think that's true.
I've had clients tell me, I had a couple come into me one time and he was always complaining that his wife would shut down. And when they were talking to me, as I made them go through a conversation they had to see what was going on, and I caught right away that when he made a certain face, didn't say anything, a certain face, that's the same face she lived with as a child with her mother. My mother used to make that face, that nonverbal message that used to make me crazy. She wouldn't tell me what happened, but she'd give me that look of disappointment. I couldn't stand that. I wish you would have hit me instead. So these nonverbal.
Oh, I knew you were going to say that. I knew you were going to say that.
Yep.
I was in an abusive marriage like that. So I know what you're talking about. Go ahead.
Yeah. So she time traveled back to when her husband made that face, and when he made that face of disappointment, she time traveled to be a scared little girl. She wasn't an adult anymore. She was that scared little girl that just shut down. So again, nonverbal messages can have a very big impact on children as well. And that's also these are the things that I bring to the light when I have sessions and stuff. Same thing.
So okay, I lived a life like that when I was a child. No messaging going back and forth. It was like we had a guy on our show at one time. He felt like wallpaper. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, he was there, a permanent fixture, but he wasn't spoken to. He was ignored. Whatever. I mean, he just wasn't there. Now that's terrible abuse. Okay.
Oh yeah.
There's
invisible.
No communication.
Invisible.
Yes. No communication,
yep.
And you can't grow. And you know that's a horrible way to treat your spouse or to treat your child. You know.
Right. Right.
They have nothing to work with. If people, you know, have words going back and forth, Like, we're having words back and forth. We're speaking. We're communicating. We can learn to understand each other. We can talk things out if we don't agree. You know what I'm saying? In a relationship, say, you can talk things out and all that. But if there's no communication and it's a silent treatment, then there's nothing to, nothing to work out. Darlene, is there something you want to say?
It's 8:25. It's almost over. The thing's almost over already.
I know. It went so fast. We only have four minutes.
No, I gave mine the silent treatment just because I knew that if I spoke a word, it was going to hit me regardless of what I say. So
right.
I didn't say
that can happen
I knew
too.
It was going to hit me if I say anything, you know.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's protection. Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess
it's like ducking.
Yeah, I was, you know, I was trying to prevent being abused, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yep.
Okay. That's, well, you know what I do is at the end of the show, and it has, you know, this show flew by. Okay, it went really fast, and I like all the things that you brought up, the points that you made,
thank you.
I like the fact that yes, and I like the fact that you are a part of the script conference. I like that. And also, too, the fact that you have been on Dr. Oz and a couple other radio stations, probably not shows, radio stations, whatever. And you have a lot to offer, Thomas. You do.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
Yes,
I appreciate
you do.
That. Thank you.
Well, that's the truth. And so what we
thank
do at the end of the show, and Darlene, thank you. It's a good thing you told me because I wasn't looking at the watch or the clock or anything. So... But what we do, and I want to thank Alex for coming on, and I want to thank Darlene for coming on, but you have about 3 minutes left. I want you to give people a last thought, something you'd like people to know, whatever. Go ahead.
Okay. Okay, so my last thought is for everyone out there that is afraid to reach out to other people. I get it. I get it. It's terrifying when you've come from a childhood like that. But I urge you to take the first step. And don't wait till you feel like doing it, because, as I said earlier, you may not ever do it. Is to take a first step to trust the healers in your life, okay, the right people, maybe a professional therapist, a group, a 12-step program, Al-Anon, whatever that is. To take a step forward, you're not terminally unique. You're not. Because when we come from a tough childhood, at best thinking may not be working. In fact, the person that you're talking to yourself may not be the person you should be talking to because of those negative childhood messages. So I urge you to just take the first step, get your feet to a healthy place, whether it's a 12-step meeting or therapist, even if you don't feel like going. Give it time. Give it 30 days, whatever it is. Give it 30 days. Recovery is a we process. It's not a me process. I could never be speaking tonight if I had to do this on my own. I never would have made it. Never. It was my healers that guided me through this. The messages that were given to them by their healers. That's what's helped me get to where I'm getting to, and that's what I give to other people. A lot of what I talk about is the messages I carried from other people. So again, get your feet where they should be. It's a we process, and don't wait till you feel like doing it, because you may never feel like doing it.
That's good. That's good. Okay. Well, I want to thank you so much for being on this show, and I'm sure that you gave a lot of people things to think about. I have this cue in my ear right now. It says we have 60 seconds working down to 30 seconds. So I would love for you to come back again, okay? And,
sure.
And we usually wait about a year, but you can always come and be a panelist. We always need to have, and to have you on the panel would be wonderful, because there's so many people would love to ask you an awful lot of questions, okay? Then you can do
sure.
that Monday through Friday. Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays we have special guests on. Tuesdays and Thursdays, those are a little bit different shows, but it's an open mic show, so people can ask questions. We have a topic, and we go from there. So keep in mind that if you want to, you know, be a part of the panel and then come on again as a guest, you're more than welcome, okay? And,
sure, and I want Could I say really quick what could help people is any way mm-hmm. you listen to podcasts, any way you listen to podcasts, I'm all over the place. Put in the problem was me in the search bar. That's the problem was me in the search bar. And I have about 24 podcasts. They're 20 minutes long that I know can help people in a lot of different areas. So I just wanted to put that out there.
Well, I'm glad you did, and I'll keep that in mind. I'll look that up myself. Thank you so much mm-hmm. for being on tonight, Thomas. It was a very good show, and you had a lot to offer people. Yes, and I want everyone to have a safe weekend, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And we'll talk to you again soon, okay?
Great. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, you're a great guest. Good night.
Tomorrow. That dawn was you are forgotten after all that you've done.
Blog Talk Radio.